Okay, I'm Kamaria Menazitz.
Hi.
Thanks, Tony. Thanks for taking the meeting. Thanks, Hamish, for your share. And thank you to everybody who does like the backstage things to make the meeting happen with the chairs and everything. So I think you don't always get acknowledged. You know, it takes all of us to make a meeting happen. And yeah, this is my second meeting today. And actually, I just want to... I just want to talk about my boiler. My boiler broke last week.
That's going to be a great chair.
Yeah. You've been waiting for this.
40 minutes of the boiling.
And basically, right in the middle of that cold snap, my boiler went. You know, we had no heat, no hot water. It took 3 engineers' visits to get it fixed. It ended up costing me £400. And, you know, that kind of thing, you know, it's like just, you know, what it does to my head, you know, it just spirals. And I just kind of start beating myself up, thinking, oh, I'm so stupid. You know, what did I earn more? You know, I just start attacking myself. You know, but it doesn't last, you know, it dissipates. And then I start kind of moving into the solution and kind of, you know, doing what I can, ringing who I need to ring, you know, and then kind of, you know, just sharing it and letting go of it. And, you know, to me, that is step 3, you know, because I used to think the steps were something kind of, I don't know, just really theoretical. And what I realise, you know, today is it's about real life, you know. And so anyway, and also to, you know, when shit like that happens, just to... You know, because I was kind of like fishing for sympathy. I put it on Facebook and somebody said, but you've still got electricity. And I just wanted to punch them. And then I thought, you know, they're right. You know, they're actually right. You know, and it's just kind of, you know, being in recovery, it's about looking, you know, it's about looking for the gratitude, you know, and it's about acknowledging what I still have in my life. You know, and yes, we still had electricity. I went out and got a couple of radiators. You know, it's fixed. Da-dee-da-dee-da. And also, you know, I went and bought myself a bunch of flowers because I just thought, you know, self-care is really important as well, you know. And, you know, I'm learning how to do that in recovery, to take care of myself. And also, you know, I went to a meeting and shared about it because I wanted to let go of it, because I didn't want my whole day to be about this problem, you know, once I'd done what I could, you know. And... that's another thing that recovery's taught me is, you know, the day can start again at any point, you know, and it just, you know, it began looking like it was going to be a total catastrophe, you know. And, you know, it is just taking those actions and then letting go of it, you know. And anyway, that's my boiler story. And, so just a bit of background about why I'm here. I'm basically here, well, I came here because I couldn't stop taking drugs. And I grew up in Brighton and, you know, kind of quite a middle-class academic family. My dad's Asian, my mum's white. They're not English, either of them. And, you know, from the outside, it was like a sort of Benetton family, you know. And but inside, it was just like my dad, you know, there was domestic violence. My dad was, like, constantly having affairs that we all knew about. You know, it's like someone was always leaving. You know, I'd be sent around the neighbours to go and call the police. It was, you know, drama, drama, drama. And I remember the number. My dad actually had 17... my mum told me my dad had 17 previous girlfriends before the one he left her for. Yeah. So it was just like utter kind of chaos. And, you know, I mean, that's not why I'm an addict, but, you know, that's the background. And you know, I think, you know, one of the things I learned from growing up in that environment was, you know, I kind of learned there was no space for me. It's like there was only one person in that household who was allowed to have feelings, which was my dad, who was a complete rageaholic. And so I learned to kind of shut down completely and kind of show my anger in really sideways ways. You know, that it wasn't safe to have feelings. It wasn't safe to be honest. It wasn't safe to be open. And I can't remember what the other thing was. But anyway, that was kind of it. And, you know, drugs, you know, I kind of reached them at a normal age, sort of teenager's age, and it was a lot of fun, you know. And it also gave me my tribe, you know, in Brighton. You know, I found a kind of surrogate family, really. of, you know, sort of misfits and people that I liked to hang out with, and, you know, I felt like I belonged, and drugs were an enormous relief from my family. And my parents both actually, they kind of split up when I was about 13, 14, and, you know, one went to live in Africa, and the other one went to live at the other end of the country. And I was left to, my sister brought me up, and she was only 18 at the time. So, you know, we were practically feral, really, and I was already kind of living with my boyfriend, you know. Anyway, so it was fun for, you know, for quite a few years. Very chaotic. I'm not going to give you my whole life story, it's going to be boring. This is the most shameful thing I can share with you, you know, is that I got into Oxford during this period. And, you know, my parents, you know, that was, you know, hallelujah, she's finally kind of like on the right track. And I only got in because they bet me that I wouldn't, bet me some money, I wouldn't. And anyway, you know, all I did there was just basically take more drugs and sleep with everybody in my year. And basically dropped out to take more drugs and do more drinking. Anyway, fast forward, because I want to get through this bit fairly fast. I ended up kind of in a squat in Whitechapel. I always went out with drug dealer boyfriends, always. Winding back a bit before this one, I always went out with drug dealer boyfriends. They always had other girlfriends. And, you know, there was usually, you know, there was, I'd get incredibly attached to them. You know, it was really unhealthy. But also, I was kind of like beaten up quite badly by, you know, one that, you know, and it's like the more he beat me up, the more addicted I was to him. You know, it was just really sick. Anyway, I ended up with this other guy in Whitechapel. It was quite a long-term relationship. He was kind of notorious drug dealer. And I have to share with you, you know, the weirdest thing is that, you know, I had this boiler thing going on, and it's been in my head, you know, for ages, and I kind of wanted to show it to me in a meeting. And I got to this meeting today, and it was just amazing. You know, it was a Just for Today meeting, and it was about turning molehills into mountains and stuff. And as people shared their stuff, you know, and they shared, not going to go into detail, but they shared about divorce, they shared about heartbreak, they shared about loss and death. You know, and my problem just shrank, you know, and I just wasn't thinking about it anymore. And the guy that I lived with walked into the meeting as well, you know, and it's, you know, that's, anyway, it's another story, but this is somebody he's been using for like 40 years straight, you know. And it just showed me I never know what's going to happen when I go to a meeting, you know, and meetings are magic, you know, and I've been around quite a long time now, but they are, you know, that is the miracle. That I think that those are the miracles that this program talks about. But anyway, get back to the story. I ended up with a heroin habit. This program is not just for people who take heroin, but that was, you know, that happened to be my drug. And I think, you know, I loved it because it kind of, you know, took me as close to feeling dead as I could be and still wake up the next day. I just did not want to be here. I did not want to deal with reality. I didn't deal with reality at all. By that time, we had a stall in Kensington Market, which, you know, I loved, and it was kind of really fun period. And, you know, there were a lot of kind of great people that I met through that. But the whole building was full of people using, you know. We were kind of dealing out of the stall. People would come to us to, you know, use in the stall. You know, we'd stay up all night, we'd go to clubs, and then we'd go buy stock and pretend to sell things, you know. it was just completely mad. We didn't kind of like, you know, we didn't kind of keep the books at all. We never paid tax. We used to get cabs over from, we lived in Whitechapel, get cabs over to Kensington. I'd puke up in the cab, you know, inevitably, because we never very high tolerance. You know, it's just utter chaos. But, you know, I think in our literature, it talks a lot about, you know, people trying to get clean for years. I wasn't one of those people. I didn't, you know, I actually liked, you know, the way my life was. And I'd become completely estranged from my family. You know, they just kind of, I was just lost. You know, they used to write letters saying, where are you? I'd ignore them. Anyway, though, And I think it would have, you know, I think it really would have continued. But what happened? And there was kind of collateral damage along the way. There was, I mean, I'm telling you this story, but there was one night in particular where, you know, a good friend of mine, her best friend had died from an overdose. And my first reaction was go and buy some vodka, score some smack, you know. And that was how we dealt with feelings. That's how we dealt with grief. And so, anyway, we kind of did all this vodka and did all this smack. She fell out of a balcony and kind of fractured her spine, was in hospital for 6 months. I miscarried. I didn't even know I was pregnant, you know. I was that out of it. And that happened, you know, through my years. I had 2 abortions in 1 year. It was so unmanageable, so all over the place, you know, and I kind of weighed about probably about 2 stone less than I do now. But I didn't really want to stop. You know, I got my family sent me on a geographical to Sri Lanka to stay with my strict Catholic aunt who didn't know what was going on. And I kind of rolled off this plane and, you know, had drugs on me, was stoned, and, you know, I think I stayed clean for about a month, and then my boyfriend came over and we scored within 24 hours, and that was that. So anyway, that's the general picture. And, you know, the reason what got me into NA was is basically my dad got diagnosed with a terminal illness, and he got diagnosed with a brain tumour and was given months to live. And I did not want to get clean for myself, but I did want, I knew he knew that I was an addict, and I wanted to get clean for him. And it's only a brief period of time when he was dying, but what it showed me was that I couldn't stop, that my using escalated, you know, there was never going to be enough to fill this hole inside of me, and that I felt like shit. Because, you know, I felt so much shame about, you know, him seeing me like that and then knowing what was going on and stuff. And, I worked with this writer one time, and I told him this story, and he said, you know what, your dad did you an enormous service, because your dad was going to die anyway. You know, and my dad's death actually shocked me into recovery, you know. Anyway, I get this call saying that he's dying, and first thing I do is kind of try and score, couldn't score, bought some alcohol, got drunk on the train, turned up. Thankfully, was holding his hand when he died. Immediately went through all the drugs he'd been on, you know, which were considerable because he had brain cancer. Didn't know what they were. I just ended up, you know, under the stairs in this dark cupboard, shoveling drugs down my face. I didn't know what they were. And because people felt sorry for me, giving me Valium as well. And anyway, just totally out of it. It was a burden to everybody at the funeral. Got in a fight with a guard on the train. And shortly after that, through a series of coincidences, got taken to my first meeting, and I did have drugs on me at my first meeting, and I don't know how I can compress this, but there were basically kind of about 3 periods to my recovery. But anyway, the first period, so I land up in NA, and very shortly after that, I was by that time I was at college, and it was like I fixed the outside, or tried to fix the outside. I didn't have, like, a habit at the time, but I had an absolute compulsion to use, you know, anything and everything I could lay my hands on. I was barely kind of keeping it together at college. Anyway, got taken to my first NA meeting, and about 3 weeks later, I was given the choice of either going to treatment or going to California for a year, which was part of my course. And anyway, took the California option, you know. And so I'm in California, and my dad's just died. I'm in a strange country. I've come out of a 5-year relationship, and I sit in meetings, and I can't say anything. Can't open my mouth. I don't know what I'm doing there. I'm scared, you know. It was being in that place where I'm really scared to show you who I am, but I'm also really scared to go back out. And I didn't, you know, I knew there was nothing left for me back out there, but I wasn't kind of ready to commit here. And anyway, I relapsed after a year, but it was a very, you know, it was like a, I think what they call a convincer, it was like half a joint or something in a Valium. You know, it was like, it wasn't a convincing use up, you know, I knew that it was done, really. Anyway, came back to London, it was the 80s and they were having this big kind of world convention in Wembley and all the Americans were coming over and I came back and I ended up getting married to the first guy who asked me out. And bless him, you know, he's a lovely guy and he's still clean. But I, you know, it was like I, you know, I was just such a lost child, basically. And it was, I think it was like I was looking for security. I was looking for something that was going to anchor me into recovery without actually doing the work. You know? And I kind of used him like my sponsor, which inevitably led to me being incredibly resentful towards him. You know? And so that marriage, you know, we had the big NA wedding and, you know, I thought that's kind of what you were supposed to do. I thought that was the happy end. If you're heterosexual, that's what you're supposed to do. Oh,
you know. Come on, carry on.
Anyway, I thought that's kind of what you're meant to do. And, but, you know, I hadn't really done the work. I'd accepted that I couldn't use anymore. I knew that was done. And I think I had a sponsor at that time, and I guess I'd done my best, but I really, really, really had not understood the depth of, you know, how deep the roots of this disease go, you know, and how many different forms this illness can take. And what happened was I ended up smashing up that relationship. I got into an affair with this someone I'd used with, who was, I mean... It's complete coincidence is how our paths crossed again, but he was actually getting married in 3 months' time, you know, and I ended up kind of get, you know, that's the guy for me. I mean, just insanity, you know. And I think, you know, part of my addiction is that, I mean, it's also like I have a compulsion, you know, as an addict, I have a compulsion to have a secret. I have a compulsion to feel shame. You know, I have a compulsion to hold something back from you. You know, and that was, you know, that's part of my reservations, you know. So anyway, kind of get into that, really, really messy. And I have to say, it made coming off heroin look like a walk in the park, you know. it took me to such a painful place. And it actually took me to an almost identical place as my drug addiction, really, because I end up, you know, I'd had sponsees and stuff by that time, you know. But it's like sponsees kind of fall by the wayside because I think people sense it when, you know, there's something kind of not kind of right, you know, even though I'm not sharing it. I end up kind of, all I could think about was this guy, you know, just like waiting, you know, for the phone to, you know, it's just complete mental obsession just transferred onto this guy. And anyway, and, you know, I end up sort of, you know, I just remember kind of, you know, being in a room with the curtains drawn, you know, and just being in such a painful place. And I ended up feeling really, really suicidal about this relationship. And actually, you know, I was so ashamed by that time. I didn't want to share what was going on in meetings. My husband was in meetings. And I ended up ringing the Samaritans, cause, you know, because I thought I was going to kill myself. So it's like, you know, I've been clean, and I'm going to say I've been clean 31 years, but, you know, I just... That was, you know, I was that close to using, you know, or killing myself, you know, and I think it's, you know, in a way it's kind of luck, but, you know, I was that close. But what it led to was, you know, a really much, much deeper surrender, you know. So, you know, and by this time I had a good job, I had a car, I had all this stuff, but, you know, it all went, you know, one way or another, it all went. So basically, I ended up having to really, really, really commit to this work, you know, and, you know, really picking up the tools, really acknowledging my powerlessness, you know, over this, you know, this disease, you know, really, really taking inventory and being honest about the shitty stuff I'd done, and sharing that with a sponsor, and, you know, and, you know, just feeling so much lighter for doing it, you know. And it's just such a paradox, you know, it's such a paradox that when I admit my powerlessness, you know, over my addiction, I get my power back, you know, and that is what happened, you know. It's like I stopped, you know, wasting hours of my life thinking about this guy, you know, manipulating how, you know, things were going to happen, you know, whatever. You know, the hours and hours that I wasted, you know, in my addiction, you know, in my secondary addiction, you know, it's like I really, really had to face up to that. And yeah, and you know, and that, you know, I believe that's when kind of really deep healing started to happen, you know, and it happens through kind of sharing the stuff that I am most ashamed of, you know, it's the thing I really don't want to share, you know, and it's not always appropriate to share it in a meeting, you know, it's not always appropriate to share it in a mixed meeting, sometimes it's with a sponsor, but, you know, it's so important that I don't keep this stuff to myself, you know. So if you're new, you know, I'd really kind of recommend that, you know, whatever it is you're hanging on to that you're feeling ashamed of right now, just, you know, try and share it with somebody. So, you know, that left me, you know, really facing that void, actually, that I'd been avoiding my whole life, you know, that I'd been filling with drugs and then filling with this person, and, you know, dealing with the wreckage of this kind of divorce and stuff, you know, quite publicly in NA and stuff. And it was, you know, but there's a kind of gift in that, you know, in that emotional rock bottom, because I also had to look at, you know, the self-will that was driving all that, you know, the defects that were driving all that, you know, and feeling so lost and so broken that I was willing to listen, you know. And, you know, I became open to hearing what I needed to hear and, you know, taking suggestions on board, doing things I didn't want to do, and really going back to the basics that got me off heroin in the first place, you know. And, you know, and it's not about a particular substance, so I need to kind of emphasise that. But, you know, so that's, you know, that's what I started to do, you know, and that's been a kind of fairly slow process, but, you know, it's been a process of kind of taking inventory, it's been a process of kind of putting down my, you know, the trigger for my addiction. It's, you know, absolutely been, you know, a day at a time sometimes, and sometimes it's been 5 minutes at a time. It's been learning to ask people for help, you know, when I feel like I'm about to act out. It's been, you know, I'm not a religious person at all, but because I've been around a really long time and I've witnessed, you know, such miraculous changes in other people, and, you know, I am somebody, you know, I can really remember what it's like to not be able to get out of bed without using, you know, and I really was that person, and I really was that person who couldn't stop using, you know, for 5 minutes, you know, I just, you know, I just kind of didn't want to be conscious. So I've witnessed these miracles, and, you know, I have a faith in step two, you know, I have a faith in the power of this fellowship, you know, and that, you know, the more I go to meetings, the more I tap into it, and the more I put into it, the more, you know, the more I'm able to kind of draw on it when I need to. And I know that, I also know that, you know, people do let you down, you know, and you know, with the best will in the world, people get busy, people aren't there, you know, at the end of the phone. My sponsor, you know, I had, you know, an amazing, you know, lovely sponsor, but she used after 20 years, you know, and she didn't tell me for 6 months, and, you know, she drank. And what that's done is kind of push me more towards the fellowship as a whole rather than one person, you know. It's like everybody's fallible, you know, nobody's got this, you know, no one, however long they've been around, you know. And I also want, apart from my boiler, I also really want to talk about 2011, which is, I was 25 years clean in 2011. I was signing on. I was a single mom of a young child who has ADHD. And that year, my sister died of leukemia, and my nephew, who I adored and was kind of like my son's best friend, killed himself. And in between times, my cat, who I'd had for 19 years, who's my baby, had to be put down. And that happened. Oh, and we got burgled really badly, and they took everything. And that happened within 6 months. And, you know, my head, I just didn't know what to do. I was like on autopilot, and all I knew how to do was to go to meetings, you know, and, you know, just share it and be held and supported and loved. And I was, you know. But the other thing is that my head says, why me? Why is this happening? You know, why? Like, I've put in the work. You know, I go to meetings, I do service. Why is this happening? And I went to a meeting earlier this week of a different fellowship, and I heard someone put it so beautifully. And she said, you know, the reason this is happening is so that you can help someone else when it happens to them, you know. And that's, you know, and that, and she also used this phrase that I love. She talks about giving meaning to the mess, you know, and that just made complete sense for me. When it's kind of all feeling overwhelming and I don't know what's going on and I feel like, you know, whatever it is up there must really hate me, you know, it just, it makes sense of it. And it kind of, I think it turns, you know, all our pain in heartache, it turns it into gold dust, actually, because it's of value to somebody else. And so this year, I have, well, this last year, I have really been putting a lot more effort into it. You know, I have commitments, I have service commitments. I take a meeting in Soho, and I go to a lot of Soho meetings. And actually, as I walk to the meeting, every time I walk to the meeting, I see people homeless in the street, I see addicts in the street, you know, and it really kind of rams it home to me what this disease can do. You know, it's a vicious, vicious illness, you know, and it can get you, you know. Doesn't matter how long you've been around, you know. And, you know, a good friend of mine that we all, you know, probably know, killed herself this year, and I spent time with her, you know. It's like there's no guarantees here, you know, and it's kind of dependent on, you know, I have to kind of, it's a daily program, you know, it doesn't matter how long I've been around. And I learn hugely from people that are kind of, you know, just come in. And I learn from sponsors, you know, having to go through step work, you know, it really makes you, you know, have to kind of like be on your game, and yet you have to know what you're talking about, and you have to kind of like keep moving forwards. And, you know, and my experience is that if I don't put the effort into moving my recovery forwards and taking it down, you know, to a deeper level, I start to go backwards and I start to regress. It's like being on this escalator that's going the wrong way, you know. And whenever I go to a meeting, you know, I just feel lighter. And it's very easy for me, you know, I'm still an addict at heart, you know, I still want to be in that kind of cave or, you know, under the stairs, not speaking to anybody. And that was a big thing for me, you know. I just, at the height of my using, I pretty much stopped talking to people. I didn't need to, you know, I had drugs on tap. And I just didn't know how to have a conversation with anybody, you know, and I was, you know, chronically shy and self-obsessed. And just doing, you know, to do service, to, you know, to take a tea commitment, you end up having to speak to people, you know, and it is absolutely the antidote for that, you know. And I think my problems are so much more complicated than that. They're not, you know. It really is about kind of, you know, just showing up. And for that 20 minutes, I don't think about myself and my shitty boiler. And the other thing, you know, I started doing this year was I did, you know, took an H&I commitment, and that has been such a gift, you know, because it really puts you in touch with what it's like to be withdrawing, you know, to have your life, you know, in such a mess, you know. And there's never a day that I, you know, from when I take that meeting that I don't walk out feeling grateful, you know, I really do. And, you know, one of the biggest gifts, and it's not about me, but one of the biggest gifts over Christmas was, you know, seeing some people that had been in the meeting that I'd taken, you know, the H&I meeting, show up in meetings outside and start to get it and start, you know, start to stick. And it really, you know, it's such a gift, you know, and I really, the longer that I'm around, the more that I appreciate it, you know, and the more evidence that I've seen of it working, you know, and I don't take it for granted. And you know, my life is not, I've had periods in recovery where I've earned a lot of money, you know, and I've had a lot more kind of external stuff. And my life's not really like that at the moment. I have, you know, I work self-employed freelance. I work with stories and fantasies, which is interesting because that's my kind of my first addiction when I was a kid, you know, it was reading. But, you know, the great thing about it is it allows me to kind of be there for my son. And, you know, he's got ADHD and he's also got this thing called oppositional defiant disorder, which means that he basically argues with you, whatever you say. You know? And it's, you know, when I think about defects, it's like it's so easy to focus on him, you know, because he's just arguing with me all the time, you know. But what it is, it's like a daily challenge, you know. It's like daily I'm being asked, you know, can I find, you know, the spiritual principles of this program when I can't remember the, you know, the text of the steps or whatever. Can I practice patience? Can I practice tolerance? And you know, that amazing thing that step 8 and 9 gives us is empathy. You know, is to imagine what it's like to be in somebody else's shoes. And, you know, I read this thing, I can't remember the exact number, but ADHD kids, they get told off a hell of a lot more, like thousands of times more than kids without ADHD by the time they're teenagers, you know. So I have to remember, it's not easy to be him. You know, his dad has never had anything to do with him. You know, he's carrying that wound, you know, and it's my job to, you know, hold him and be there for him, and being in recovery allows me to do that. And, you know, and I have this life where, you know, I can be there, you know, I'm there for him as best I can. You know, I do lose my temper with him sometimes, you know, but I have the tools, you know, to make amends, you know, and he's grown up with that tool himself, and he sometimes gives it back to me. He sometimes even talks about, you know, seeing the positive and, you know, you know, well, at least this hasn't happened. And, you know, he was doing it when the boiler was broken, you know. And, you know, he's getting little bits of recovery. You know, he's a recovery baby. He was brought in, you know, when he was 2 weeks old, he was, like, parked under a chair at a meeting, you know. And I love that. I love that he's being brought up in an atmosphere of recovery. And, you know, I can focus on the negative, which is his dad's not around, or I can focus on the fact he's, you know, he's lucky enough to be brought into, you know, a world of recovery. You know, and you know, and he's amazing. You know, and I love him. And he tells me, I tell him I love him every day. And sometimes he says, "Stop telling me you love me, Mum." But it's like, I want him to feel wanted. You know, and I just kind of, you know, and being in recovery and being in meetings, that, you know, more than anything else, it's taught me how to give and receive love. You know, which I had no idea about. You know, absolutely none. I was just so shut down and so self-obsessed. And so, you know, I want what I want now. Thank you. And, yeah. So life is, you know, it's life on life's terms. And, but what I would say, I don't know what to say. I don't know, I feel like I'm supposed to say something really profound, I can't think what it is. if you're new, I would say you don't have to wait 30 years. You know, it's all there for you. You know, I would say what has made a lot of difference in my recovery is to turn up a bit early to meetings, turn up 10 minutes early to meetings. You know, find the meeting you like, find the tribe you like. There's hundreds and hundreds of meetings in London. Get a commitment, you know, preferably 2. And I would try and get to 3 meetings a week. And go out for coffee with people afterwards. I mean, that was the hardest thing for me, you know. I just, to feel like, you know, I'm just like everybody else. You know, that's a miracle for me, you know. And to know that, you know, you've all kind of been there. You know, you've all kind of like had heartache, you've all had loss, you've all kind of felt overwhelmed and I don't know what to do, you know? And What else was I going to say? When I got clean, there wasn't any internet, you know, or any mobile phones, you know, just bizarre. But it, you know, it's. I know, sorry. You're going to say something about my age now. But, you know, but it is about, you know, the antidote to my addiction is connection. You know, it's about action and connection, you know, and there is no reason to not feel connected, you know, in this social media age. And I love that, you know, not that I want to go to this meeting, but I do love that, you know, NA seems to be full of teenagers these days, you know, and it wasn't when I got clean, you know. But I have to say that, you know, sometimes I'm going to look at them and say, they haven't done enough, you know. It's like that head can start, you know. And it's just rubbish, you know, it's utter rubbish, because my first friend in recovery when I was in California was... she was 18 and she got clean when she was 14, you know, and I was like gobsmacked. I was like, how could you, you know, what? And actually she was a runaway and she, you know, she's definitely had enough, you know. It's not, you know, it's not about time, you know, it really isn't. You know, it's about that kind of, you know, desperate place that, you know, it takes us to. And yeah, I love NA. I feel really, really, really privileged to have found it. You know, and you know, I hope to stay here. Thank you.